Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you for tuning in. If you're listening to the show the day it comes out, then you'll know that we have just passed the very popular Western holiday, Halloween. However, it's often said that the real Halloween isn't on a calendar. The real Halloween is in our hearts. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hi, I'm Noel. Ben, who said that? Who can we trace that quote back to?
Me, about 3 or 4 seconds
ago. That's good. That's one for the books. It's true. And, you know, we're nothing here on Ridiculous History, if not slightly behind the curve, which I think we pride ourselves on.
Yeah. It's one of our Men's Warehouse-esque guarantees.
Is it behind the curb or the curve?
Curve. It's the curve. With a V. Yeah. Like okay. A statistical curve.
Ah, yes. See, my brain immediately eschews any kind of mathematic connection. So I think curb, like being behind the curb. I don't know what that would even mean, though. It would mean that you're not in the street.
Right. It would mean you're not jaywalking.
Exactly.
Which goes back to one of my favorite episodes that always pitch off air, the history of jaywalking. Don't ruin it for yourself. Don't look it up yet. Instead, look up to, like we look up to, our super producer, Casey, the Madman Pegram.
The Madman?
Yeah. I just felt like it was, you know, it's a good thing. I have this image of you, Casey, because you are so wise and sagacious and measured. I have this image of you based entirely on just my own daydreams, my own Walter Mittyings of you being this incredible Hulk-like figure and occasionally being moved to righteous indignation such that you have supernatural strength. What do you think about that?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know if I could go full Hulk or just stay in the more measured Bruce Banner mold, but you know, I get passionate about stuff.
That's true. We have spoken about film at length, and also I think there were times when we were working really closely in our former video department where I can't remember the specific shoot we were on, but there was some moment. We were working with someone, and they had botched something relatively simple, and you were very patient, you were very kind, but I could tell it was getting to you, and I was like, hey, man, just remember, Casey Pegram does not suffer fools. And there was a pause, and you said something like, I do not.
And then proceeded to have a Christian Bale-esque meltdown.
Oh, yeah.
You're a nice guy.
The guy was in my eye line. What do you want me to do?
I know, man.
But you and me were done professionally. That's not true. Casey on the case. Dun. Today's episode is a little bit different for us because it's almost a compilation episode, is it not?
Something of a mixtape. Mm-hmm. As the kids would say.
Or a horror anthology.
Whether or not it is or is not fire is up to you to decide. Not you, Ben, but you, the people.
Right. Not you, Noel, not you, Casey, but you, specifically you listening to this. Today we're exploring a strange and somewhat extraordinary cultural trend from the 1800s. So, you know, nowadays, in these our modern times, we see a lot of cultural trends, right? We see some predictable ones, like we've passed Halloween now, so we're going to see a lot of Christmas stuff. I'm sure people's local department stores, especially in the Western world or the Anglosphere, scramble to populate the shelves with Christmas items, right? As soon as it's November 1st.
Really. I find it disgusting.
I find it somewhat disingenuous. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any GM or CEO who has this moment where their heart grows 3 sizes and they say, you know, Christmas, why it should be every day. I don't think they have those moments. I think they just know that for a lot of brick and mortar stores, Christmas is the big opportunity to go from red ink to the black. But with that being said, these are cultural trends. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about Christmas at length in the following months, in the following episodes. Well,
it'll be like 2 weeks late for Christmas, though.
Yeah, yeah. It'll, you know, it might be February. It might be March 2020.
We'll get around to it.
We'll get there. We'll get there. It might be, you know, Christmas episodes you save for December 2020. But one of the weird cultural trends of the 1800s was the proliferation of spooky stories.
As I like to call it. The spooky.
Mm-hmm. Spirits, ghosts. Some of them were very old legends, sort of regurgitated, remixed for the mixtape, right?
Mm-hmm. We got your witches. Mm-hmm. We got your ghouls, your run-of-the-mill ghouls. What else we got?
We've ghost trains, strange supernatural events. Of course, they're like vampires, succubi, incubi. Mm-hmm. It's strange because the 19th century, when we look back on the 1800s, a lot of times we think of it as a time of innovative science and pioneering technology, right? Like one of our favorite guys who's been showing up a lot, your favorite tortoise eater.
You're talking about Darwin?
Yeah. We think of Darwin and stuff like that, right?
The beauty of eating a tortoise is the shell kind of is its own, like, bowl situation. You just flip it upside down, and it's already, like, it's a portable kind of situation.
And it's kind of a to-go box because there's the undershell.
If anyone's triggered by this, any turtle lovers out there, I apologize. We probably should have done a trigger warning talking about dissecting and eating your beloved pets. But you know what? That ship has sailed. That tortoise has swum.
Yeah.
That 8-bit Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle has gone down the sewer hole.
Yeah.
Was that off mic we were talking about that video game?
That was off mic.
Dang it. That's fine.
We talked at length off air about some of our favorite old school NES, SNES, Sega Genesis games. And, you know, hit us up with your favorites, especially if they're obscure. It's weird, you know, Heroes in a Half Shell aside, the strange thing about the 1800s in the Western world, of course, was that while we look back on it as a century built on the concept of reason and deduction and scientific acumen, there was also this huge, profound, abiding interest in the supernatural. We see there the rise of, what were they called, spirit photographs, for instance?
Yeah, like where you could see like an aura kind of situation or like a ghostly luminous cloud.
We also see this underlying fascination with the otherworldly. And it's strange that this happened at the same time that we saw this tremendous series of breakthroughs and leaps in the realm of science. So one of the questions that historians ask about this, we saw a really good article on this in ThoughtCo.com, was maybe really weird things were actually happening all the time. And now with the rise of better communication and better photography, we were able to just document them more accurately, you know?
This is interesting, too. A big rise in the popularity of spookies came directly as a result of economic changes in the Industrial Revolution, right? Because a lot of folks, there was sort of this new middle class that was being created. A lot of folks that had grown up in rural areas moved into cities to potentially become staff for this new middle class. And they were in these kind of alien, kind of creepy environments, right? Where every little spooky sound or creaky board, you know, could potentially be a signifier of some kind of ghoul.
Yeah. These servants also, if you think about it, they were kind of expected to be ghost, right? They weren't supposed to be heard. They were like, what's the old adage, seen and not heard? But then sometimes they weren't even supposed to be seen. Didn't they have like secret doorways and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, they essentially haunted these houses as the living, which makes a lot of sense given the nature of, like, for example, the haunting of Hill House, right, on Netflix. That's one of these kind of houses. So there's all kinds of secret passages, and it would have been a house where there would be servants' quarters and a lot of, like, hidden doors and places for folks to be able to slip in and out easily. But when you kind of separate it from the function of it and the slightly offensive bouginess of it all, you do get some opportunities to have some pretty creepy situations, right?
Yeah, exactly. This reminds me of one of my relatives used to live in a very, very old house out in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee. And it was a house that had a servant's stairway and then servant's quarters. And it was very brick and, you know, in young Ben Bolin's mind, it was absolutely haunted. It was terrifying. They raised a kid there, and the kid used to just stare off in a certain corner and have conversations with things that weren't there. So I absolutely believed in this. We also see another way. So you mentioned socioeconomic factors. We also see the way that technology could have accelerated or exacerbated, is a better word, this belief in the supernatural. Think about the lighting, right? One of the famous quotes about film is that film is painting with light. We know that light plays this huge role in our day-to-day existence. In the 1800s, lighting was increasingly provided not by candles, but by gas lamps. And there's an interesting theory here about how gas lamps could have given rise to more belief in ghosts. A lot of this is coming from a wonderful interview with Ruth Robbins, who is a professor of English at Leeds Metropolitan University.
Yeah, and Robbins cites the fact that the carbon monoxide that gas lights – see, this is, I can't ignore this. I know we talked about the term gaslighting came from a play.
Right.
But the idea that the gas emitted from these gas lights would cause you to hallucinate – and believe things that weren't really true.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, maybe it's all kind of bundled in together, you know?
Yeah.
The idea of gaslighting someone being to kind of convince them that what they think is true is not, in fact, true, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this was a real thing. It could potentially cause people to get a case of the vapors, as it were, and start seeing spooks and specters and ghouls and goblins and all that jazz.
Yeah. And we know that whatever the case was, whatever the causes were, whether it be a fundamental change in the socioeconomic landscape, the proliferation of carbon monoxide hallucinations, or, you know, just a proliferation of ghosts, we know that there was a huge amount, a preponderance of people encountering what they believed were spirits in their daily life by the middle of the 1800s. And we have a specific example. Well, we have a series of specific examples for today's episodes. Here's one. In 1848, there were these sisters in New York, the Fox sisters, and they claimed they heard a series of tappings.
Didn't we have a story about the Cock Lane ghosts back
exactly,
in the day?
Exactly.
That
yeah.
had to do with tappings?
Mm-hmm.
And where did this this obsession with tappings come from, Ben?
Right. The obsession with tappings, it depends. Are you asking a skeptic or are you asking a true believer? A skeptic would say, tappings are easier to fake.
That's also true. But the obsession or the notion of tapping as a form of communication came again from technology, right? The proliferation of Morse code and being able to tippy-tap your messages across long distances, right?
Absolutely, because maybe a ghost has been expelled from the mortal plane for hundreds of years, but they're keeping up to date in the latest technology. And I love that you bring that point up, Noel, because when you think about it, that's kind of like a ghost now choosing to communicate solely through Snapchat and TikTok because of how new the tech is.
Absolutely. I mean, the Snapchat icon is a spooky ghost, in fact.
Yeah. Think about it. Maybe we are not so far removed from the 1800s as we would like to tell ourselves.
So back to the Fox sisters.
Right. The Fox sisters have a story worthy of its own episode. But the takeaway from the Fox sisters that sets us up for the rest of today's explorations is this. Robbins says it best, I believe, when she says, if you can have people communicating from 3,000 miles away, relating to Morse code, words coming across the ocean, tapped out Morse code, then it's a small leap of the imagination to tell yourself, there's a dead person who I used to know quite well who is talking to me through Morse code. We can see the internal logic because it's very easy to frame the conversation with yourself as something like, well, the ghosts were always trying to communicate with me. It wasn't until this technology, this code evolved, that we were able to successfully do so. So now we're in a situation where science does not negate spiritualism, but aids and abets it.
It's interesting, too, because like we see it all the time where, you know, with the rise of intellectualism or science or technology, you kind of have a backlash for a thirst for sort of the old ways, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what you see a little bit here in that confluence where they kind of bolster each other on the one hand, but also there's sort of like a divide between technology and spiritualism. It's interesting.
It is. Let's dive into some of these spine tinglers from the 1800s, some of which will doubtlessly be familiar to you, fellow listeners.
Yeah, this one in particular might be if you're a fan of Holly and Tracy and Stuff You Missed in History Class, where they have an entire episode on the Bell Witch and how the Bell Witch was a source of absolute horror for a Tennessee family, in addition to having a little bit of a historical connection with our boy Andrew Jackson. This story has proliferated throughout history and involves a spirit with ill intent, in theory, that haunted a farming family, the Bells, in northern Tennessee in the year of 1817.
Oh, yeah. This is one of those spooky stories that every resident of Tennessee knows, just the way that we all are familiar, or at least all of us in the eastern part of Tennessee are familiar with the fast food chain Pals. Get there if you can. Do not delay. Back to the Bell family. So in 1817, there's a farmer. His name is John Bell. He sees a bizarre creature hunched down in a nearby corn row. And he thinks, you know, I'm probably just looking at some large dog. And this creature, be it canine or not, stares at Bell, and Bell fires a gun at it. The animal runs off. No big whoop, right?
I think it was He Who Walks Behind the Rose.
It could have been, but probably not, because the way He Who Walks Behind the Rose is depicted, at least in the Stephen King short story, it's much more of like an elder god entity. So it would be larger. The movies are different.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Can you really ever walk behind Rose? Don't you walk between them?
Well, if you're mortal, yeah, mortal man can only walk behind a row,
the outer
if
row,
it's the last row,
last one.
And then it's behind several rows, exactly. Unless there's a single line of corn.
Exactly. So, as you say, Ben, he shot his shot a couple of times, and the creature vanished, and he didn't really think much else of it. But then there became this what's described in various sources as a beating sound, which is akin to a tapping. It's more of an urgent tapping, wouldn't you say? And the sound continued. They were hearing it outside of their log home, their log cabin, and it continued, and its urgency increased. The frequency of it increased every single night until Bell and his boys went outside to try to find the source of this sound, and every time they found nothing. And then, following that occurrence, each night all of the Bell children began waking up in a horrible panic and fright, and they thought that rats were inside the house that infested their tiny log home and were gnawing at their bedposts.
Yeah, there were other weird sightings or purported weird sightings of animals. There was the strange black dog, they called it, showing up. They saw, not John Bell, but another family member saw a bird on a fence, and he thought he was shooting at a turkey, but it took off and it flew over him. It was much larger than a turkey, and it could actually fly. Just going to go on record here, Casey, I don't know if you have to edit this because we are a family show, but even now, it is well known that turkeys are complete a-holes. It's one of the only things all the residents of Boston agree on. So, like you said, Noel, they're hearing these strange noises, and then these noises seem to escalate until whatever this apparition or this force or this spirit is, it begins to speak to the family in a strange voice. And John Bell gets these weird physical symptoms. His tongue swells such that he cannot eat. And they finally tell some neighbors, some friends, about the weird stuff happening on the farm. And the friend and the wife come to investigate. And according to them, or according to the official story, when the visitors were at the farm, they stayed overnight. A spirit came into their room and pulled the covers from their bed.
Classic ghost flex right there.
Yeah.
They just want you to be chilly. Because if you got the covers off, it's a lot easier for them to get you all chilly.
And as we learn from a young age, there is no better insurance against things that go bump in the night than a good set of covers over your feet and over your head.
Yeah, but now with the improvement of jump scares in horror films and them being PG-13 now instead of R, because they're less focused on gore and they're more focused on spookery, right? So a lot of times you'll have the kid under the cover, and then what happens? The ghost is up under there with him or her.
Yeah. You know, I still think it depends on how you tuck the sheets.
You know what you do is you got to do that hotel tuck.
Yeah.
Where you got to, like, pull with all your might.
Three sides.
Exactly.
Under the mattress. Yeah.
No ghost can penetrate the hotel tuck.
The hotel tuck, which is a lot less dirty than it sounds. If we just use the hotel tuck as a phrase.
That's a pro move right there. Yeah. The hotel tuck.
Good old hotel tuck. Also, adding "ol" in front of anything makes it sound like an even worse euphemism. We talked about this on air.
I don't remember, but I agree with you right now.
Awesome. Well, here's the formula real quick. I don't want us to run long. You take any word that you, any innocuous object or noun. Like, Casey, what's a easy just noun? First one that occurs to you, an object.
Chips.
Okay, chips. So now we add a place name. So Noel, what's the name of a place? Any place?
Cambridge.
Okay. And then we...
These should be crisps if it's Cambridge.
Cambridge in Boston.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay, so we've got Cambridge chips. Now we just have to add "ol" on there, and it's going to sound like a creepy euphemism when you say, oh, you know, I met a girl, we liked each other, we hung out, we had some drinks. Next thing you know is the old Cambridge chips.
Zing!
Right? And Pazoon. It doesn't mean anything. Yeah. So Chattanooga handbag, etc. Anyway, back to the old Tennessee Bell Witch. We know about this story, the Bell Witch story, because there was a lot of press advertising it. And as you said, the Bell Witch would torture most of the family members, right? Throwing them on the ground, sticking pins in their bodies. John Bell, the patriarch, eventually was attacked, and apparently an invisible foe beat the snot out of him. The fame of this Bell Witch grew, and word of it spread throughout Tennessee, the hollers and the valleys. And then supposedly Andrew Jackson heard of this. This is Andrew Jackson before he's president, right?
Right, Ben. So Andrew Jackson, as you know, was a born and raised Tennesseeman, right? He's your kin, at least by proximity.
Geographically related.
Geographically related. And before he was president, he was already known across the land as a top-notch war hero. And so being, you know, kind of a Gaston-esque figure, that sounds like I'm being... He was tough. He had like a puffy chest, you know, but he was not a mean guy like Gaston. Actually, we don't know that. He could have been a jerk, but who are we to say? Point being is he wanted to come to the aid of the Bell family, at the very least, you know, get a look-see for himself as to what these spooky happenings were all about. So Jackson came, according to, let's just call it myth, legend.
Sure.
Came from his home in Nashville, where he was already a decorated general, at that point a major general, and supposedly he came to visit the farm and had dishes thrown at him. All kinds of spookery was afoot. He purportedly was quoted as saying he would, quote, rather fight the British again than face the abject horror that was the Bell Witch, and then took his leave the next morning after spending one spook-filled night at the Bell Farm.
Tabloid gold.
Right? It did. It smacks of incredulity.
Mm-hmm. The very model of a modern major general, right, has this issue. Anyway, long story short, 1820, about 3 years after the beginning of this story, John Bell is found quite ill, the story goes, next to a vial of, quote, strange liquid. He died to, you know, everybody at the time believed that he had been poisoned. His family members gave some of the liquid to a completely innocent cat.
To the family cat.
Who just happened to be in the room.
What a weird detail. What? Were they just trying to test it on the cat?
Yeah.
They couldn't have given it to like a chicken or like a livestock or something, you know?
I don't know, man. They did that cat dirty.
They must have not really cared too much about that cat. And they believed that it was the spirit, the infernal spirit of the Bell Witch that had forced Bell's hand and caused him to drink this poison. And supposedly after Bell's death, the spooky happenings came to a close.
I call, just as Casey would say, IMHO, I call BS on this. Casey, do we have a BS sound cue or BS alert? Because it sounds like someone corporeal poisoned the guy, you know what I mean? And you could get away with calling it a ghost. But again, this story is fascinating to the nation at the time, because there's this idea, you know, it's 1817, 1820, it's a little bit early, but there's this idea that scientific investigation can be brought to bear upon this phenomenon or upon this series of events, and that the scientific investigation might not necessarily disprove a paranormal occurrence, but that the very same technological innovation that we have now may indeed be able to prove scientifically something about what lay beyond the veil of this veil of tears.
Ah, like tears in the rain.
Tears in the rain. It's interesting. Oh, man. I guess we have time for what? One more?
I guess one more. Wasn't it Blade Runner Day the other day?
It was. Well, November, right, is
November 2019 is the opening card in Blade Runner.
Yeah, so yeah. We're in Blade Runner territory now.
I know. I love it.
Still can't get a good walk-by noodle stand in Atlanta.
It's true.
All the good noodle places are sit-down joints.
Is that really your takeaway for the things we're lacking in supposed Blade Runner time?
You're not worried
about the lack of
oriented.
Flying cars or anything? Yeah.
Flying cars, man. It took me years on car stuff to deal with it. Flying cars are cool as long as one person has one. The rest, if everybody has a flying
car, you imagine?
It's pandemonium.
Yeah, I mean, think about this. Like, we would need air traffic controllers for just like, you know, our commute.
We could do it with autonomous vehicles. Now we're talking science again, but how soon before we get a good autonomous vehicle haunted house story, you know?
Oh, that'd what a good crossover. That'd be what they call a remix. Can we get a air horn sound here? All right, cool. Yeah, I love that.
Did you ever hear the CVS remix, the CVS jams?
CVS bangers.
CVS bangers. Right. Thank you, Casey. Casey of the case.
And there was also Walmart ones, too. There were at least someone uncovered, like, just hours of, like, Walmart canned music.
That one made me intensely nostalgic. Like, the Christmas holiday Walmart mixtape. Mm-hmm.
You know what I love? It's almost like a secular version of a church, or maybe it's a haunted house of capitalism. I used to go to 24/7 grocery stores, like Kroger's. There were a lot of those around here. And just stroll through the aisles at 3:30, 4 in the morning. And there was something lonely and beautiful about hearing that terrible music, because you know that the people working don't really have a lot of control over what radio station is getting played. But
this is very true. Totally separate, but similar. Yeah. I had a really melancholy and kind of almost borderline creepy brush with that kind of capitalism. The first time I landed in New York City very, very late at night and was staying right off of Times Square on a Sunday and walked through Times Square full on Christmas mode, lights blasting, not a single soul in sight.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
very yeah. strange.
It's like Vanilla Sky.
It's very much like Vanilla Sky or like 28 Days Later or something like that, the Christmas edition.
So is capitalism the ghost that haunts America? That may be a story we get to in the future, but for now, let's talk about, okay, so we teased vampires, we teased railroad hauntings. Let's go with railroad hauntings for now, because vampires are kind of ageless and timeless. Railroad haunting seems very 1800s.
It does. And, you know, and if you are interested in vampire situation, you want to check out the New England Vampire Panic, which would have been what we would have talked about today, you can go to our sister show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, and just search the archives for New England Vampire Panic, and we did an episode on that. Some time ago.
If it's not an audio podcast, definitely done as a video, but fascinating story. Don't want to spoil it for you, but the New England Vampire Panic is one of those paranormal stories in which we do find a direct definitive answer.
Speaking of paranormal occurrences, Ben, someone slipped into this document just now and highlighted everything in pink, and it's not you because you don't have a computer in front of you, my friend.
No, it was me from earlier.
Yeah, but it wasn't highlighted, and now it is.
It just happened
it
while
just
we
happened.
Were on air?
Yeah.
Interesting. All of the doc?
No, just this story about the decapitated train conductor.
Casey?
It's probably just slow Wi-Fi or something.
Maybe. I don't like it. So, yeah, the decapitated train conductor who would swing a lantern near the place where he ultimately met his end.
Yes, yeah. So the railroad, since we're speaking of science and spiritualism, the railroad is one of the bangers, the breakout singles of technology in the 1800s. And I know, we all know that it was around before them, but this is where it really, it mainstreams. And not only does the railroad become a great source of communication, of transit, of trade, it also finds itself being a great source of folklore. There are so many stories from this time of ghost trains. And Noel, how would you describe a ghost train?
It's like ghost riding the whip, right?
It's similar, yeah.
It's like an autonomous car.
It's very loosely similar.
Very loosely similar. No, a ghost train is a train what hath no conductor.
And what hath no corporeal form.
Oh, the train itself.
Yeah, the train itself.
Okay.
You hear the choo-choo in the distance, and nobody's been on these tracks for now on 50 years.
Do you see some sort of ghostly luminescent shape of a train, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one famous ghost train story.
There's also ghost ships too, right?
Yes, many. Yeah. Actually, I think I'm just going to have to write this horror story about a haunted autonomous vehicle. But yeah, there are all sorts of ghost ship stories, the Flying Dutchman being one of the most famous. Ghost trains are another iteration of this sort of folklore. But unlike ghost ships, they can be sighted on regular routes because they usually follow the tracks where the tracks were.
Right.
One of the most famous was apparently the ghost of Abraham Lincoln's funeral train. It was apparently draped in black, and that's true. President Lincoln's train was draped in black, but it was manned not by people, but by skeletons. Since that's so well known, we wanted to find another railroad train-related ghost story, and we found a pretty cool legend from the 1860s.
So, one dark and stormy night in 1867, there was a railroad conductor of the Atlantic Coast Railroad by the name of Joseph Baldwin, the spookiest name in all of folklore. And he did not mind the gap when stepping between two trains that were parked at a station in Maco. What do you think, Ben? M-A-C-O, North Carolina? They've always got weird pronunciations. It's probably Maco.
It's probably like Macau.
Macau.
Or it may be Mako.
Exactly. Sort of like in Georgia, I believe, there's Cairo, but it's pronounced, no, there's, it's spelled Cairo, but pronounced Cairo. Anyway, I
digress.
It's a whole
thing. It's a whole proper thing. Proper nouns in general.
So yeah, he did not mind the gap. He stepped between these two coupled cars. The train, the locomotive engine began to move unexpectedly. And, poor Joe Baldwin lost his head.
And he went out as a true humanitarian. You see, gather around the campfire here. Joe Baldwin's last act was to swing a lantern to warn other people to keep their distance from these dangerously shifting cars. And in the weeks following this tragic accident, people began seeing a lantern moving along the nearby tracks. But this lantern had no hand holding it, had no man swinging it. Instead, the lantern hovered above the ground about 3 feet, bobbing as if being held by someone searching for something. According to veteran railroaders, this was the dead conductor himself, Joe Baldwin, looking for his head.
Yeah, because when I said lost his head, I was being literal.
Yes, yeah,
he,
yeah.
He didn't just get very upset when he tripped and bumped his knee. No, he was decapitated.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's, I love a good headless ghost story, Ben. Remember that one from Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark?
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert for this quite old book of spooky children's stories, but she has the ribbon around her neck,
yeah.
The story just ends with, and then her head fell off.
That's a great, you know, and Schwartz, the guy who wrote, or compiled a lot of these, is a fantastic folklorist. The art is also amazing.
I actually think the updated versions of that don't have the old creepy art, because that was the part that was the most upsetting.
Right. Well, that's what made it the edgiest thing you could get from the Scholastic Book Fair. And shout out to anyone else who remembers that. Did you guys have that?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Scholastic was huge. I mean, the closest thing I can compare that art to, it's like Evil Stedman. You know, it has that,
it's
like pen
good.
And ink splattery quality, but it's even creepier than Stedman art.
That's the guy who did a lot of
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yep.
So yeah, I think it is a little bit creepier because of the gradient involved, and Stedman is a little more stark blotchy lines.
The one that's like burned into my head is the girl in the shower with the spiders.
Oh, yeah.
Which I believe makes an appearance in the recent film adaptation of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which I haven't seen, but I've heard it's quite good.
I was going to see it too, but someone told me it was for kids. And I thought, yeah, so is the book series. Anyway, you know what? You can't die on every hill. You got to pick your battles. And Joe Baldwin picked his. People began saying that they would see two lanterns. This is how folklore works. Now, it's two lanterns. One is apparently Joe's head, and the other's his body. They're looking for each other for all eternity, which doesn't make sense unless the head can float and is holding the lantern in its, you know, in its jaw and its mouth, or unless the head has become a lantern. I don't know. Anyway, these things became known as the Mako lights, and here's another common folkloric trope.
Oh, the ghost lights.
Ghost lights.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Will o' the Wisp and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But even more specifically to the 1800s, often the president of the U.S. shows up, is somehow involved in these stories. And this time, according to the legend, it's President Grover Cleveland.
Just so, Ben, just so. In 1880 or around about in the late 1880s, President Grover Cleveland was just, you know, passing through the area, and he heard the tale, and he began to tell it at dinner parties, the tale of old Joe Baldwin and his ghostly light. And that is credited with popularizing the story and making it part of the oral tradition.
Exactly. Reports of the Mako lights continued past the 19th century, pretty far into the 20th, I believe at the time of recording, the last sighting occurred in 1977.
Yep, and that's what they say there over on ThoughtCo.com with their list of supernatural and spooky events. Also, at NorthCarolinaGhost.com/coast/Mako Light.
So This ends today's episode, but not our show. We want to hear from you. What are some of your favorite stories from the time of spiritualism versus science, or spiritualism in a strange collaborative team up with science? What really gets in your historical craw about this period in history? For me, I'm fascinated continually by the strangely specific acts of spiritualists and mediums, like ectoplasm alone. Did you ever read much about that?
Mainly just, you know, what I learned from the Ghostbusters films.
Ah, yes, yeah. I've got some great Time Life books that I'll bring in. I loved them as a kid.
Why was the slime pink in part two and green in part one?
I wouldn't know, because I didn't know until you told me.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know.
You haven't seen part two?
No, I've seen both. I just can't really easily differentiate the colors.
I keep forgetting about your color deficiency. It's really a superpower. It probably has focused your brain in other directions, I'm certain.
I gotta say, man, Ghostbusters, you know what? Who cares that Halloween is over in terms of this year's calendar? Let's do a Ghostbusters-related episode next. What do you think?
Ben, I support that wholeheartedly.
And I support you wholeheartedly, my friend. You know who supports us? Hopefully, luckily, wholeheartedly. It's our super producer, Casey. Big thanks to you, man. I'm just going to lean out of the booth and make eye contact with you real quick. Boom, that guy.
They're literally pressing their palms against the glass. like that scene in Titanic. But not really like that scene in Titanic either. It does get a little steamy in here in shipping container from time to time.
It does.
So indeed, big thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme, who also has a heart full of spooky love. And you should check out his show, Ephemeral, where he actually did a spooky story as well, written by Richard Le Gallienne, which was originally published in Harper's Magazine in January of 1912. Called The Haunted Orchard, narrated by Peter Yearsley of audiobook fame, and Alex Williams adapted it with sound design and music and his typical brilliant sonic touches. So check that out. Big thanks to Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit.
Big thanks to our regular rotating cast and crew. We've got Eves Jeffcoat. We've got Gabe Luzier. We've got, of course, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, who is just trolling us hard on one of our favorite sites on the web, which is our Facebook community page, Ridiculous Historians.
Yeah, join us there. All you got to do is say one or both or you know, whatever combination of letters in our names that'll let us know that you kind of know who we are, or just, you know, make a ref of some kind.
Make us laugh.
Make us laugh, anything like that, and we'll let you right on in. If you want to check us out on social media, we're Ridiculous History on most of the social outlets. If you want to follow us individually, you can check me out exclusively on Instagram, where I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
And you can find me getting kicked into and out of various countries, places, and communities on Instagram, where I am at Ben Bolin. You can find various hot and cold takes alike, where I am at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter. We do not have a call-in line, which is probably for the best, but we do have an abiding obsession with all things ridiculous throughout history. So let us know what you think your fellow listeners would enjoy next. If you hate the social meds, totally get it. You can send us a good old-fashioned email. We're ridiculous@iheartradio.com.
And if you're feeling charitable, go over to your podcast platform of choice and leave us a kindly review. We'd appreciate it very much. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.